friends. Welcome back for another episode of the It's Murder Y'all podcast. I'm your host, Amber, and with me today is a man who is tin roof rusted. My husband, Rob. Say hey, Rob.
Isn't that the B-52s?
That is the B-52s.
Okay.
So
I understand.
I'm about to explain it. So I heard Love Shack.
You lived in Athens for a while.
Exactly. I heard Love Shack this morning when I was taking the kiddo to school. And that's always been my favorite part of the song. But the B-52s are from Athens, Georgia. And although today's case takes place in North Carolina, it does have a connection to Athens. So I was like, you know what? I needed an intro for today's case anyways. Tin roof rusted. That's what we're going to go with. So
I don't understand what that means, though.
I think
I don't
it's
feel
just...
like a tin roof rusted motherfucker.
So back in the day...
I said that. Came out to get early with the MF-er. Sorry about that, y'all.
It's okay.
We cuss and shit.
We absolutely do. So back in the day, I loved pop-up video. And so the pop-up video to this song said that people thought that tin roof rusted meant being pregnant. But
what the hell does a rusted tin roof have to do at all with bearing a child?
Right. It doesn't. I think I read somewhere that the chick that sings it, like, she messed up. And when she messed up, she just randomly said tin roof rusted. And they were like, that's funny. We'll put that in the song. But that I also read that on the internet. So is it true? We don't know.
Probably not.
So last year, when I decided that I wanted to start a true crime podcast, there were a handful of cases that I knew that I wanted to cover. And three of those were our first three episodes. One is an episode that'll come out this summer, and one is today's case. It is a case that has always stuck with me. And while it did garner national attention at the time, there's been surprisingly very little coverage within the true crime podcast community. And I wanted to introduce it so that folks that may not be as familiar with it would know this person's story. So, with that being said, you ready to get started?
Yay.
Yay. So, it's a little after 5 a.m. on March 5th, 2008, in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, when a call comes into the local 911. Alexandria Bukinski tells the dispatcher that she'd heard a gunshot, followed by a woman's scream and three additional gunshots in rapid succession behind her house on Maryland Drive, which is about a mile from the University of North Carolina Chapel Hill campus. A few minutes later, Chapel Hill Police Sergeant Scott Felice found the body of a young woman lying dead in the street at the intersection of Hillcrest Road and Hillcrest Circle. She was lying on her back, tilted onto her left hip, and her right arm was bent above her head, and she was surrounded by a large pool of blood. Sergeant Felice could see a silver dollar-sized hole in her right temple and a gaping hole in her right hand. The young woman had long, light brown hair and was wearing a light gray t-shirt, dark blue sweatpants, and light-colored tennis shoes. She had a necklace with a small gold locket around her neck and a paper wristband around her left wrist that said "Be True" on it. Investigators examined the area around the body and found four 25-caliber shell casings, but nothing else. The young woman's body was transported to the medical examiner's office for her autopsy in hopes that maybe through that process they'd be able to identify additional clues to not only her murder, but also to her identity. According to the autopsy report, the young woman was 5'5" tall, 138 pounds, with brown eyes and straight, light brown hair that was approximately 15 inches long. She also had a small beauty mark below her left eye. The autopsy actually said a small raised brown mole, but I think that beauty mark sounds better. So, the medical examiner found six injuries, which were the result of five gunshots, which I will explain in just a second. So, I'm going to list out the wounds as described in the autopsy report. So, if you don't like hearing the gruesome details, you might want to fast forward just a little bit. So, first wound was a gunshot wound to the right cheek, with a small caliber bullet being found in her left maxillary sinus. Second gunshot wound was to the right shoulder, which injured her fourth rib in the back, the upper and lower lobes of the right lung, the right hemidiaphragm, and the small intestine, with a small caliber bullet being found somewhere in the torso. It didn't say specifically where, but I would imagine the small intestines, because that was like the last organ that they mentioned being damaged. She had a perforating gunshot wound of the right upper arm. And a perforating gunshot wound means that the bullet had an entry wound and an exit wound, so it didn't get stuck in the body. In this case, the bullet entered the back of her upper right arm and exited the front of that arm. She had a perforating gunshot wound to the right buttocks. The bullet entered the right butt cheek, traveled slightly downward, and exited through the vagina. This next part is where the 5 gunshots, 6 gunshot wounds come in. So the victim had a perforating gunshot through the right hand and a corresponding gunshot wound to the right temporal scalp. So basically the right temple. So this indicates that the victim put her hand up to protect her head and the gunshot went through her hand and into her head, killing her almost instantly. Unlike the other wounds, which were the result of a small caliber weapon, the medical examiner found birdshot pellets in both the hand wound and the wound to her temple. So, because I know nothing about guns, how big is like a 25 caliber? Like, is that going to leave like a big hole or is that going to leave a little hole? Because that was the smaller of the guns.
There are factors at play that depend on the exit wound and entry wound and all that shit.
Okay. What about a shotgun with birdshot? Like,
I mean, in the name, birdshot from a shotgun is designed to not destroy a bird, but just kill it. So think of the difference between like ball bearings versus, so buckshot is like ball bearings. That's what you're shooting at deer and big game with a shotgun. Birdshot is more like everything but the bagel seasoning.
Okay.
You know what I mean? It's like bits like that. It's like little tiny, it's smaller pellets. It's like little tiny BBs.
Okay. I didn't realize that. So I actually have a copy of her autopsy report, and in it, they have illustrations of all the wounds. And so the wound to her hand, it looks like, I mean, it basically blew a big hole through the palm of her hand.
Yeah. I mean, it'll fuck shit up, but the survival chances of birdshot versus buckshot are dramatically different.
Yeah.
I mean, if you shoot somebody in the face at a certain specific range, birdshot or buckshot, they're gonna die. But right. You know.
Yeah, like even in this case, even though her hand like blocked some of the force, it still ended up killing her when it hit her in the side of the head.
See?
And I didn't want to spend a whole lot of time on this, but all of these wounds are awful. But the one that entered her butt cheek and exited her vagina, as a woman, I'm just like, Jesus Christ. Like, of all places.
Chances are high that the one that got her in the face was hurting a million times more than the butt cheek with JJ one.
Well, yeah, because the one in her cheek.
Yeah. Because
the one to her that went through her hand and hurt, that was the last one. That killed her.
Yeah. Whatever hit you in the face is going to hurt way more than whatever hits you in the your cash and prizes.
Can you imagine getting shot in the butt and it coming out your wiener? Or to be more anatomically correct to where it came up for her, imagine, we're going to get real technical, the juncture between your wiener and your balls, it came out there.
Yeah, I'm very aware of what the gooch area.
No, it wasn't the gooch.
I mean, for a man, that's what the gooch is.
I thought a gooch was your balls to your butthole. I'm talking about I'm talking about the spot where your balls connect to your penis.
Oh.
It's not your gooch.
No.
Unless I've gotten male anatomy mixed up.
No.
Yeah. It wouldn't be fun.
We just talked about anatomy hardcore for a second.
We did, with not great anatomical names. Also,
I thought you were about to say Grace, and I was like, yeah, that's pretty accurate.
Yep. And again, I will always say this. I don't know shit about guns, but...
And listen, I'm not a ballistics expert. I just was trained how to shoot a bunch of different shit in the Army. So what the fuck do I know?
I've held a gun 3 times in my life.
Well, I've done that quite a bit more than you,
but
for sure.
These gunshots... So discounting the hand and the final one, if we're looking just at the first four... Those seem like random shots. We've got cheek, shoulder, upper arm, butt cheek.
Not a well-trained shooter.
Which will make sense when we find out who did it. So one bright spot, the only bright spot in this whole situation, was the fact that During the autopsy, it was found that there were no signs of sexual assault. So the victim was not sexually assaulted before she was murdered. Police still don't know who this young woman is, but given her proximity to the UNC Chapel Hill campus, it was assumed that she might be a student. So the university put out an email alert to students in hopes of identifying the victim. Anna Lassiter, a student at UNC, had been out of town and was on a plane back to North Carolina when she got the email alert, but she didn't really think anything of it at the time. When she got back to her house at 202 Friendly Lane, her roommate Justin Singer told her that he hadn't been able to get in touch with their other roommate, Eve. He knew that Eve had gone to the Florida State UNC basketball game the night before. Then she went home to do homework, and that's what she was doing when he left the house at 1:30 a.m. to go to the bar. But when he got back to the house at 4:30, 3 hours later, Eve's SUV was gone. The door to the house was open. The house lights were on, and Eve's books were still in the den where she'd been working on her homework when he left. He called her cell phone, but she didn't answer, so he thought, you know, maybe she's gone to campus to print out a paper or make copies or something. She never came home, though, so he was, you know, he was concerned. So Anna and Justin went out looking for Eve, but they didn't have any luck. And Anna started thinking about that email alert that had been sent out, specifically the part about the victim wearing a gold locket, because she knew that Eve always wore a gold locket necklace. Around 2 a.m. on March 6th, so the day after the body was found, Anna went to the Chapel Hill Police Department and told police that her roommate had been missing, and she was concerned that she might be the murder victim they'd found the day before. Investigators showed Anna a picture of the dead woman, which Anna said later was, quote, just her face with a gunshot through her cheek, end quote. And she confirmed that, yes, that was her roommate, 22-year-old Eve Carson. So, who was Eve Carson? What was her story? Well, Eve Marie Carson was born in Athens, Georgia, on November 19th, 1985, making her a Scorpio. And as we've said before, it's a good year. It's a nice vintage because it's when we were born. To parents Bob and Teresa Carson, Eve attended Clark Central High School in Athens, where she was a valedictorian and student body president for the class of 2004. She was a member of the school's academic team, was on the soccer team, was vice president of the school's National Honor Society. She served as a page in the U.S. House of Representatives. She worked as a lab assistant in a stem cell research lab at the University of Georgia. And she volunteered as a peer educator at the Athens Area Attention Home, which is a safe house for abused, runaway, and homeless teenagers. Eve had shown extraordinary promise from an early age, and though she was offered scholarships to both Yale and Princeton, she decided that she was meant to be a Tar Heel. So she began her freshman year at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, in fall of 2004. Now, we have talked about some very high-achieving women in previous episodes, and I've always considered myself a high achiever. I say all the time I have a pathological need to be exceptional. But Eve Carson puts all of us to shame. I'm going to read an overview of Eve's time at UNC that was written by the UNC chancellor. He wrote, Eve came to Carolina in the fall of 2004 as the recipient of a prestigious Moorhead Scholarship. A member of the Phi Beta Kappa Honor Society, which is one of the most prestigious honor societies you can be in college, Eve was a pre-medicine student majoring in both political science and biology. As a North Carolina fellow, she was part of a four-year leadership development program for undergraduates. While at UNC Chapel Hill, she was extremely active in both leadership and service roles. As student body president, she was also a member of the UNC Chapel Hill Board of Trustees. She served as co-president of the Honors Program Student Executive Board and as a member of the Committee on Scholarships, Awards, and Student Aid, the Academic Advising Program, and the Chancellor's Committee for University Teaching Awards. Teaching and working with children were key service interests for Eve. In 2006, she taught science at Frank Porter Graham Elementary School in Chapel Hill as part of UNC's Inspire program, whose mission is to encourage young students to pursue science as an interest. In her junior year, Carson was a tutor at Githens Middle School in Durham. She was also an assistant coach in the Girls on the Run of the Triangle, a character development program for girls ages 8 to 12 that uses running to teach values and a sense of self. Eve's service extended well beyond the triangle, however. In the spring of her sophomore year, she participated in a study abroad in Havana, Cuba, and she spent her summers working and volunteering in Ecuador, Egypt, and Ghana as part of the Moorhead Summer Enrichment Program. I credit my prior experiences, especially my past two Moorhead summers, for preparing me to get along with pretty much whatever comes my way, she wrote in an email posted on the Moorhead website. On campus, she became involved in Nourish International, an organization started by UNC students in 2002 for hunger relief. Eve served as freshman volunteer coordinator and co-chair for the group. So if you didn't catch that in her biography, she was the student body president at UNC Chapel Hill, which is a big deal. During a meeting of the North Carolina House of Representatives the day after the murder, David E. Price, who retired last year after more than 30 years as representative for the 4th District of North Carolina, said of Eve, quote, "I recently met Eve at a reception hosted by UNC's Chancellor James Moser. My wife and I were impressed with this lovely young woman who, it was clear to see, had so much potential to make a difference in the world. She expressed to me her interest in working abroad after graduating in May, perhaps in Africa. At the time of her death, my office was working to help her find a way to realize her goal. Unfortunately, Eve will not be able to realize that goal. Our community is deeply sad at the loss of this special person. We also regret the loss for all those who would have been touched by Eve's big heart in the future. This is truly a loss for us all," end quote. To say that Eve Carson was remarkable truly is an understatement. So I've worked with thousands of college students, many of whom were outstanding students and very high achievers, and none of them, not a single one, has been on Eve's level. And from everything I've read, she was also an incredibly sweet and caring person too. And an estimated 10,000 UNC students attended a campus memorial service for Eve. This was a devastating loss for the campus and the community. So back to March 6, 2008, and Eve Carson has been identified as the woman who'd been brutally murdered and left in the street. Now that they have a name, police are able to focus their investigation because they know what they're looking for. They need to find her car, which is a blue 2005 Toyota Highlander. They need to find her cell phone, and they need to track her bank cards to see if anyone had been using them. Investigators were able to trace Eve's phone to a wooded area near U.S. Highway 15501. Later that day, Eve's SUV was found near the intersection of North and Hillsborough Streets, which was only about a mile from Eve's house. The Highlander didn't have any damage and didn't appear to have been involved in a struggle. A witness would tell police that he had noticed the SUV when he had left for work at around 6:30 a.m. on March 5th. He said it stood out to him because it looked like it had been parked in a hurry. Now that they have her phone and her car, investigators wanted to try to nail down a timeline for what went down on March 5th between 1:30 a.m. when her roommate Justin last saw her and around 5:15 a.m. when she was found dead in the street. And if you think about the fact that her car was seen at 6:30, it's like a little over an hour later. So this is a pretty tight timeline from the time that, you know, she was last seen till she's murdered and her car is dropped off somewhere. So from looking at her computer, investigators were able to see that she had last used it at 3:37 a.m. We know that her roommate Justin came back at 4:30 a.m. and Eve wasn't there, so that is an even smaller window. Police start looking at Eve's bank records, and there was definitely some suspicious activity. At 3:55 a.m., so what, like 20 minutes after she'd last used her computer? At 3:55 a.m. on March 5th, someone withdrew $700 from Eve's account at the Bank of America ATM at the University Mall in Chapel Hill. Five more attempts were made to withdraw money from the ATM, but they were unsuccessful. At 4:44 a.m., someone attempted to withdraw $200 from a Bank of America ATM about 12 miles away at the Northgate Mall in Durham. At 12:35 p.m., someone tried unsuccessfully to use Eve's debit card at a convenience store in Durham. Then at 2:16 a.m. the next morning, they went back to the Northgate Mall ATM and withdrew another $700. Three additional attempts to withdraw money were unsuccessful. So they've tried a bunch of times. They've only successfully withdrawn money twice, and it was $700 each time. So I'm getting the vibe that $700 was probably the max amount you could withdraw in a day or at a time. But whoever was withdrawing the money wasn't very bright because they did not catch on to that. On March 7th, so now 2 days after the murder, two more attempts were made to withdraw money at a convenience store in Durham, but by that point, the bank had placed a hold on the account. So we have this person or persons who's been using Eve's card to try to get money at ATMs and convenience stores. Now, what is something that both ATMs and convenience stores have? Dun, 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 surveillance cameras. So investigators work on trying to pull surveillance footage. And unlike other cases we have covered, they actually got lucky. The University Mall ATM captured footage of a young black man wearing a Houston Astros baseball hat and a hooded sweatshirt, driving an SUV that appeared to be Eve's Toyota Highlander, and he was using Eve's bank card. On March 8th, 3 days after the murder, police released the photo to the public and asked for help identifying the person in the photo. 2 days later, police released two new surveillance photos, this time from one of the convenience stores. Police received hundreds of calls that day, but it only took one. On March 12th, Shanita Love called and gave police information that connected her boyfriend, 21-year-old Demario James Atwater, and his friend, 17-year-old Lawrence Alvin Lovett Jr., to the murder. I couldn't find exactly what Shanita told the authorities, but we will learn more about what she knew in just a little bit. So let's talk about Demario Atwater and Alvin Lovett for a minute. And so if you see things written about this case, they will call him Lawrence Lovett. But from what I read, he went by Alvin. And I'm also a member of the Middle Name Club, and I don't like being called by my first name. Although he doesn't really deserve that in this episode, I do like to try to be mindful of that. But I'm pretty much just going to call him Lovett for most of the episode. So first thing to know about these two dudes is that they both had extensive criminal records despite their young ages. Lovett had only been 17 for like 2 months. So he's a fresh 17. Lovett had been convicted of drug possession, larceny, breaking and entering, and felony possession of a firearm, and he was on probation at the time of Eve's murder. Atwater had been convicted of marijuana, possession of marijuana with intent to sell, trespassing, robbery, and assault. And like Lovett, Atwater was on probation at the time of Eve's murder. But he had actually violated the terms of his probation 2 weeks before the murder. He had been arrested for carrying a gun, which, as we know, is not something that you can do when you're on probation. Unfortunately, he was released on a $10,000 bond and was supposed to appear in court on March 3rd. But somehow, the case got assigned to the wrong courtroom because someone wasn't paying attention to what they were doing, so it had to be rescheduled for March 31st. Had Atwater gone to court like he was supposed to on March 3rd, which was 2 days before the murder, there's a very good chance that we would not be talking about this case right now. Demario Atwater was arrested on March 12th, 2008, and was charged with first-degree murder. He had been identified as the man in the convenience store surveillance footage. Lawrence Alvin Lovett Jr. was identified as the man in the ATM surveillance footage, so he was arrested and charged with first-degree murder of Eve Carson. And he was also charged with the first-degree murder of Duke University graduate student Abhijit Mahato. 29-year-old Abhijit Mahato had been murdered on January 18, 2008, about a month and a half before Eve was murdered. Abhijit was born in India on May 26, 1978, making him a Gemini. Y'all, I'm going to do my best with these pronunciations. I have this accent. I literally try to look up every single word. I've written them phonetically. I promise I'm trying. So, from what I gather, Abhijit was originally from Titanagar, India, but grew up in Calcutta. He was an outstanding student who enjoyed math. He earned an undergraduate degree in mechanical engineering from Jadavpur University in Calcutta and a master's degree in mechanical engineering from the Indian Institute of Technology at Kanpur, earning a perfect GPA. After finishing his master's, Abhijit worked as a research engineer for GE India. In 2006, Abhijit left India to pursue his doctorate in engineering with a focus in computational mechanics at Duke University in Durham, North Carolina. I looked up computational mechanics and I couldn't even understand the description of computational mechanics. It is that advanced. So we are talking about a very, very smart person. So, and plus Duke is a really good school. So, a fun fact, I don't even know if you know this, Rob. Had I not gone to Alabama, the only other school I wanted to apply to was Duke.
Yeah.
Did you know that?
You mentioned it.
What do you know? I forget. After all these years, I forget what I've told you. And half the time, I don't know if you've listened to me or not. So This was the first time that Abhijit had traveled outside of India, and his parents were understandably worried. For the next year and a half, though, things seemed to be going pretty well. Abhijit had made friends, and he was doing well in his program. He typically called his parents once or twice a week, and he had become close with some relatives of a friend from back home, and he visited them every weekend. In January 2008, though, Abhijit was busy preparing for his qualifying exams, which are sometimes known as comprehensive exams or COMPs, which is what my master's program called them. And those are required before moving into the dissertation stage of the doctoral program. So I know from my COMPs, it was basically a test of, and it could be on anything that you learned in the any of the coursework you had done in your master's program. So it was very overwhelming. So studying for COMPs can be very stressful and very time consuming. So Abhijit was spending much more time at the lab, sometimes late into the night. Although they knew he was busy, Abhijit's friends became worried when he just stopped answering his phone. On the evening of January 18th, 2008, five friends stopped by Abhijit's apartment on Anderson Street, which is about 2 miles from Duke University's campus. Inside the apartment, friends found Abhijit dead with a pillow covering his face. His murderer had covered his face with a pillow, pressed the gun into the pillow, and fired one shot into his face. Like in Eve's case, someone had used Abhijit's bank card to withdraw money. In the early morning hours of January 18th, 2008, someone withdrew $520 from Abhijit's savings account, taking everything he had in the account aside from about $5. What's interesting, though, is that they didn't touch his checking account, which had over $4,000 in it. Also, when you're, first of all, don't rob anybody. But if you're going to rob someone, a graduate student is not the person you want to rob, because graduate students are not making a lot of money. So security footage from an ATM on University Drive in Durham, which is about 2 miles from Abhijit's apartment, showed a light-colored Mercedes pull up to the ATM and sit for about 3 minutes. At 2:12 a.m., they withdrew $200. At 2:13, they withdrew $60. And then at 2:14, they withdrew $260, which seems like a weird way to do the transactions. Like, why? I don't know why they would do that, but it was similar to how the money was withdrawn in Eve's case as well. So whoever was taking the money wasn't doing like, okay, one transaction, give me all this money. It's like, I'm going to take this random amount. And then like 2 minutes later, I'm going to take another random amount. Like, I can't think of a reason why you'd do that unless you were just stupid, which they were probably stupid. So unfortunately, the surveillance footage captured the car, but didn't capture the person that was in the car. We'll talk more about Abhijit's case later on. But for now, let's go back to Eve. On March 31st, 2008, Atwater and Lovett were officially indicted on first-degree murder charges. On July 7th, a judge added charges of first-degree kidnapping, first-degree robbery with a dangerous weapon, felonious larceny, possession of a firearm by a felon, and felonious possession of stolen goods. Atwater was also charged with possession of a weapon of mass death and destruction, because he had been caught with a sawed-off Harrington & Richardson Topper Model 158 12-gauge shotgun, I don't know if I said all that right, with a barrel that was less than 18 inches in length and or had an overall length of less than 26 inches. In other words, he got caught with a sawed-off shotgun, which is considered a weapon of mass destruction, and that is not something I realized until I was researching this case. Did you know, Rob, that sawed-off shotguns are considered weapons of mass destruction?
No, I did not know that, but I know sawed-off shotguns are kind of a no-no.
Yeah, you will get in a lot of trouble if you are caught with a sawed-off shotgun. So let this be a learning moment for anyone listening to this that may have one. You need to not have one. Not that I think anyone that's listening to this has a sawed-off shotgun. Anyways.
You don't know what people got.
That is true. Maybe I have one.
No.
In one of my purses. You don't know me. Anyways, on October 27th, 2008, Atwater was also indicted on federal charges of carjacking resulting in death. So, because this is a case of murder plus other bad shit, specifically carjacking, kidnapping, this became a capital murder case. Atwater could see the writing on the wall. He was a black man in North Carolina that brutally murdered a successful, pretty white girl. There is no way he was not going to be put to death. So in April of 2010, He went ahead and pled guilty to federal charges of carjacking resulting in death, kidnapping resulting in death, carrying and using firearms during and in relation to carjacking and kidnapping resulting in death, possession of a firearm by a convicted felon, and possession of a short-barreled shotgun without such weapon being properly registered. He was sentenced to life in prison plus 30 years. So just so people know this, typically if you plead guilty, they take the death penalty off the table. So, which is why he pled guilty. He was sentenced to life in prison plus 30 years. He was also ordered to undergo substance abuse treatment. And should he ever be released from prison, which the judge said was highly unlikely, he would have to pay $212,947.10 in restitution. That is a very specific amount, and I don't know how they came to that amount. At a sentencing trial, Atwater made a statement directed at Eve's parents saying, quote, "I'm sorry for everything that's happened. No matter what the court did today, it would be far from anything I should receive," end quote. The next month, Atwater also pled guilty to state charges of first-degree murder, robbery with a dangerous weapon, first-degree kidnapping, and possession of a firearm by a felon. By pleading guilty, the death penalty was off the table, like I said earlier, and he was sentenced to life in prison for the murder and 23 to 29 years for the other crimes. So he had two life sentences plus 30 years plus another 23 to 29 years. So he's going to rot in prison. He's not going to get out. So Atwater pled guilty to avoid the death penalty, but the death penalty was never an option for Lovett. As we discussed in the Hardy's episode, in the 2005 Roper v. Simmons case, the Supreme Court ruled that it was unconstitutional to sentence someone to death if they were under the age of 18 when they committed the crime. I guess since the death penalty wasn't on the table, Lovett decided to take his chances with the trial, and he actually pled not guilty to all of his charges. So, Lovett's trial for the murder of Eve Carson began on December 6, 2011. One of the key witnesses in the trial was Shanita Love, DeMario Atwater's ex-girlfriend and the one that turned Atwater and Lovett into the police. According to later appeal documents, Shanita testified that, quote, "She and her children lived in an apartment in Durham with DeMario Atwater, his mother, sister, and three brothers." That's a lot of people in one apartment. Lovett was a friend of Atwater's siblings and often stopped by the apartment. On March 4th, 2008, Atwater left the apartment after 10 p.m. and returned about 5:30 the next morning. Later, when Atwater saw the still image from the bank surveillance footage on television, he called Lovett into the room and told him that his picture was on the news. Lovett replied, "Oh, shit," asked to use the phone, and left. On March 8, 2008, Shanita accompanied Atwater, his brother, and Lovett as they disposed of pieces of a .25 caliber handgun. On the same day, Atwater and Lovett broke up a sawed-off shotgun on some bricks and put the pieces into grocery bags, which Atwater disposed of, end quote. A friend of Lovett's named Jason McNeil also testified. He told the court that Lovett had called him on March 4, 2008 and asked him to drive Lovett and Atwater to Chapel Hill, but Jason was busy and couldn't give them a ride. So as a side note, there are a lot of similarities between this case and the Hardy's case from episode one, and this is one of them. Remember, Greg had called a friend to give him a ride, but his friend wasn't able to borrow his parents' car, so he ended up walking to the Hardy's. So Jason said that Lovett called him again on March 12th, so this was the week after the murders, and asked Jason to come pick him up. Lovett told him that he needed to get out of town because Atwater was, quote, going to tell. Jason asked him what he meant, and Lovett proceeded to explain what went down on the night of the murder. According to Jason's testimony, Lovett told him that the night that he had called Jason, he ended up not needing a ride because him and Atwater had taken Lovett's mama's purple PT Cruiser. They'd been prowling around looking for someone to rob when they saw Eve get into her car, and they rushed over. Lovett got into the driver's seat. Atwater got into the back seat with Eve and held her hostage with a gun to her head. They went to the ATM machine to get money, and the whole time Eve was pleading for her life and telling them that they did not have to do this, that they could take whatever they wanted. Jason asked Lovett what led to them murdering her, and Lovett said it was because she had seen their faces. That was their fault for not covering their faces, but also, they killed her because she had seen their faces. Then their dumbasses went to places with surveillance cameras and everybody saw their stupid faces. So it is even dumber and more senseless that she had to die because they're morons. So Jason continued with the story, saying that Love and Atwater took her to a wooded area about a mile from the UNC campus. When Eve realized that they were in fact going to kill her, she asked them to pray with her. Instead, Lovett fired four shots from a 25 caliber gun into her body. She was still alive, though, so Atwater shot her in the head with a sawed-off shotgun. As we discussed earlier, she'd put her hand up to shield her head, so the birdshot went through her hand before hitting her right temple and entering her brain. A forensic psychologist and criminal profiler had previously told WRAL News that the manner in which Eve had been killed showed a, quote, complete lack of regard for another person, end quote. And I feel like the way that Lovett callously described the murder to Jason only bolstered that opinion. At the end of the day, the witness testimony was just the icing on the cake in this case. They had Lovett on surveillance camera, in Eve's car, withdrawing money from Eve's bank account with her bank card. They'd also found Lovett's DNA on the interior driver's side door panel of Eve's Highlander. I think one thing that people don't understand about DNA is we're constantly leaving DNA. And they can get DNA from your skin cells. So if you touch something, like he touched the door handle, they can get your DNA from that. It doesn't, they don't have to just have like bodily fluids. They also found footwear impressions in the interior of the vehicle that were found to be consistent with Lovett's shoes. On December 20th, 2011, Lawrence Alvin Lovett Jr. was found guilty on all charges and sentenced to life without the possibility of parole. Like in the case of Greg Wynn and the Hardys case, though, Lovett's sentence would later be vacated and there would have to be a new sentencing trial thanks to the 2012 Miller v. Alabama case, where the Supreme Court ruled that mandatory life sentences without the possibility of parole were unconstitutional for offenders who were juveniles when they committed the crime. Now, just to clarify, when it comes to this ruling, sentences of life without parole are still permissible, but they can only be imposed after judicial consideration of the individual circumstances, and the court must consider the offender's maturity level. So basically, they can't be like, you did this shitty murder and you're going to go to prison forever. They have to look at kind of the situation around the murder, and also the offender's age and their maturity level at the time of the murder. Lovett's resentencing hearing took place on June 3rd, 2013. Prior to the sentence being handed down, Lovett told the court, quote, you know, people make mistakes. Nobody's perfect. I'm not the monster that y'all made me out to be, end quote. And that very much reminds me of statements that Greg Wynn made after his trial for the murder of Denise Bliss in episode one. And just like in Greg's case, Lovett's new sentence was the same as the old one, life without the possibility of parole. Orange County District Attorney Jim Woodall said of Lovett, quote, he is a predator. He does not care about consequences. He does not care about other people. He cares about one person. He cares about Lawrence Lovett, end quote. D.A. Woodall went on to say, quote, I do not think Lawrence Lovett has any remorse. I think his only remorse is that he's been convicted and he's going to spend the rest of his life in prison, end quote. The next year, Lovett went to trial for the first-degree murder of Abhijit Mahato. Prosecutors contended that this was an intentional, deliberate, and premeditated murder of a man who did nothing wrong except be outside his home at the wrong time, which is the same thing that happened with Eve. And it's scary that, like, you can't even walk outside of your house. Like, we don't know for sure what Eve was doing, but it is likely she was just going to run to campus, like her roommate thought, to print a paper or make copies or something. And they got her as she was getting into her car. The prosecution's strategy for this trial was to establish that Lovett had a habit of violent behavior, and they had more than two dozen witnesses who could testify to that. DeMario Atwater's mother, Peggy Mabry, testified that she had seen Lovett driving a gray Mercedes in January 2008, and if you'll remember, a light-colored Mercedes had been seen on the ATM surveillance camera withdrawing money from Abhijit's savings account. Shanita Love testified in this trial just like she did in the trial for Eve's murder. She said that she had heard Lovett talk about how he and Philip Mabry, who was DeMario Atwater's brother, had taken Abhijit to the ATM, withdrew the money, took him back to his apartment, and shot him in the head through a pillow. The defense tried to convince the jury that the prosecution had no solid evidence to prove Lovett's involvement in the murder. They didn't have DNA or fingerprints. They didn't have any eyewitnesses. The only thing they had was the word of random people that may or may not be credible. Now, despite the stark similarities between Eve's murder and Abhijit's murder, Lawrence Alvin Lovett Jr. was found not guilty of the murder of Abhijit Mahato. Shortly after the trial, Durham Police Chief Jose Lopez said that he was reviewing the investigation into Abhijit's murder But 10 years later, they've still not charged anyone with the crime, or anyone else besides Lovett with the crime. In an interesting twist, Shanita Love was arrested in October 2014 for the murder of 51-year-old Lee Charles Covington. She was ultimately found guilty of second-degree murder and sentenced to 15 years in prison. So you would have thought she would have learned something from testifying in two murder trials, but nope, she ended up having one of her own. So we're recording this episode on March 6, 2024, which means that yesterday was the 16th anniversary of Eve Carson's murder, and there's been a significant effort to keep Eve's memory alive in the years following her death. Several scholarships have been started in Eve's name, which is particularly appropriate because Eve's student body president platform included points related to making school more affordable for students. She wanted UNC to put forth more predictable tuition increases, let students know ahead of time, and she also wanted to work towards getting scholarship money for students. Each year, Pi Beta Phi Sorority and Phi Delta Theta Fraternity host the Eve Carson Memorial 5K for Education. Shortly after her death, someone anonymously donated what is known as the Eve Carson Memorial Butterfly Bench to UNC's campus. The bench is made of steel that is painted Carolina blue. It is in the shape of a butterfly and it is approximately 4 feet tall and 4 feet wide. In 2010, UNC Chapel Hill dedicated the Eve Carson Memorial Garden in memory of UNC students who've died while enrolled. The garden features a seating area and a curved marble slab inscribed with a quote from Eve, quote, "Learn from every single being, experience, and moment what joy it is to search for lessons and goodness and enthusiasm in others," end quote. And that was the case of the brutal and senseless murder of Eve Carson. As I mentioned in the beginning, this case has always stuck out to me. Eve was born about 3 weeks before I was. We graduated high school and started college in the same year. I was on the UNC Chapel Hill campus just a few months after her murder, and Lawrence Lovett's murder trial happened the same year that we moved to Athens, you know, which was Eve's hometown. So it was on the news and in the papers a lot at the time. I think more than anything, though, her case just makes me so sad because we're the same age. And so all of these different milestones that I've had in my life, you know, she was murdered 2 months before graduation. She didn't get to graduate from college. She didn't get to go to grad school. She didn't get to get married or have kids or do anything else. And she absolutely would have been doing something amazing. And I think the world really missed out because two stupid guys wanted some money. So, Rob, do you have any final thoughts on this case? Because you've been quiet.
I mean, people just be murdering people for the stupidest of reasons.
They really do. And
I mean, it's pretty fucking ridiculous at this point.
And every murder that we cover is sad. And we've covered, like, you know, the Crystal Faye Todd was god awful, and the Santa Claus murders were god awful. And this is just like a different level of sad. Like, it was so completely random. So random. She just happened, like, if she had left her house, you know, 5 minutes earlier, 5 minutes later, or, you know, had decided to go with her friends or had gone to bed early, she'd still be alive. And she was poised to do so much. And it's just really, really sad. Like, I don't know. Her case has always bummed me out. And like I said, it's always been weird to me that it's not discussed that often in the true crime community when, I don't know, it's always stood out to me. Well, thank y'all so much for listening to the It's Murder Y'all podcast. As always, sources for this episode will be listed in the show notes. I'm also working on a website so I can start putting the sources on that instead of clogging up the show notes. So please subscribe, rate, review, tell a friend, tell your mama. Like, seriously, if you like the podcast, please go rate and review so that it helps get the word out about the podcast. We will see y'all next week. Lord willing, and the creek don't rise.
Peace out.